Hello. I hope you've all enjoyed your tea and a little bit of English countryside here at Glen Eyrie. It's my pleasure to introduce to you this afternoon our guest lecturer for today, Mr. Donald McGilchrist. Donald and his wife, Jeannie, moved here from England in 1976. A graduate from Oxford University with an MA in philosophy, politics, and economics, Donald has worked on the marketing side of the tobacco and transportation industries for 10 years. From 1971 to 1976, he worked as the European director for the Navigators based in London, England. He currently is one of three international vice presidents for the Navigators. While Colorado Springs does not have the ancient or illustrious history of, say, London or Oxford, Donald has immersed himself since being here in Colorado Springs in discovering our past, and particularly the history of Glen Eyrie and its founder, General William Jackson Palmer. The maps, charts, photographs, and notes from interviews that are all over Donald's office attest to his thoroughness as a historian. And the librarians at both the Tutt Library at Colorado College and the Penrose Library downtown, they know him well from the many hours he has spent uncovering these documents. It is from Donald's vast knowledge that I have personally come to know a lot about these grounds and have come to appreciate the beauty that is here and the history that is here. And I think that you will be very stimulated by his large understanding and of this historic home, and in particular, his valuable insights into the horticultural significance of Colorado Springs, of Glen Eyrie in Colorado Springs history. So, Donald.
Thanks, Katie. Good afternoon. Wasn't that a splendid tea? Very elegant indeed. Thank you, Katie, for the introduction. I must say that I am delighted at this new initiative, the launch of the Glen Eyrie Garden Society. I look forward with confidence to the transformation that will take place over the next couple of years in these grounds, thanks to our president, Katie, and her enthusiastic team. I think they're going to accomplish a lot, and it's a splendid concept. I'm sure you would agree. It's an honor to be part of this endeavor. Now, a handout is being given out to you. It's a very simple handout. On one side of the piece of paper, there is a brief history of the ownership of Glen Eyrie, and on the other side, some details on the cups that have been won by exhibits from Glen Eyrie. We'll refer to that later. The history of the gardens of Glen Eyrie. Preparing for this has been, for me, a formidable yet a fascinating task. As far as I know, nobody else has ever attempted such a lecture. But I do draw courage from the presence in this room of so much horticultural and so much historical expertise. So I know that whatever I don't say correctly will be put right graciously and effectively later. I'd like especially, before I begin, to recognize Rhoda Wilcox. Rhoda, as most of you know, is the historian of Glen Eyrie, particularly General Palmer and his marvelous contributions to this city. So we're very pleased that she is here with us today. 100 years ago this month, General Palmer returned to Glen Eyrie from England, sadly without his beloved wife, Queen, who had died a few months earlier. He brought with him their three daughters, Elsie, Marjorie, and Dorothy. They arrived here in style in 1895, a night in Niagara Falls, a night in Chicago, a night in Denver, and then a presidential progress down the Front Range in his special rail car, Nomad. For the rest of 1895, the three girls kept a diary of what they saw around Glen Eyrie. The birds, the flowers, the weather, and the visitors. We still have this diary in their handwriting. They mention at least 58 species of plants, both cultivated and natural. As children often do, they planted optimistic seeds down by the schoolhouse in the valley, which the general's Great Danes promptly rolled on and dug up. So not much came of that attempt at horticulture. 1895 was a wet year. The Glen gave them a lot of concern lest it overflow. But the interesting thing, I think, for us is that the average rainfall 100 years ago in this area was only about 11 inches a year. Now it's about 15 inches a year. There's been quite a change in the climate. It's become considerably wetter. This Glen Eyrie property now encompasses around about 800 acres. Within a very compact area, there are five main ecosystems. There's the grassland down at the entrance to the glen. There's the riparian area along the banks of Camp Creek. There is the mountain shrubland. There is the pinyon and juniper woodland. And then finally, at the western end of the valley, the ponderosa and Douglas fir forests. Five systems within 800 acres. Truly fascinating. Matters are further complicated by the large planting program that General Palmer engaged in. He planted more than 1,000 exotic trees and shrubs to add color and variety to the native vegetation. Some examples of this would be the Japanese lilacs and the green ash that we pass as we drive in and come to the castle. Palmer spared no expense in developing his estate, even though he was periodically short of money until he finally sold his railroad in 1900. He was a visionary, as many of you know. He once wrote to his beloved wife, Queen, "There is a music in the inception of large material enterprises." And this certainly was that. Yeah. And I found letters from General Palmer exulting in this glorious country, this country of bright days and beautiful skies. He loved this land. In 1992, a few years ago, we carried out a census on the vegetation of the Glen. We identified and documented 97 species of vegetation. We're going to use this as a baseline study so that in the years ahead, our successors can see in which way the vegetation has increased or decreased. But let's go back and deal with this chronologically, and let's start in the 1870s with the name of John Blair. John was born in Scotland, a few miles from the Duke of Sutherland's castle at Blair Athol. He emigrated to Canada. He did landscape work for Senator Austin of Illinois. Austin's family started sheep ranching out here in the area which is now called Austin Bluffs. And so Blair was drawn out and visited our city. He met General Palmer and started a lifelong friendship. He settled in Manitou and became the general's landscape architect. Most of the work that he did at the Glen was finished by 1884, and his last visit here was in 1900. He put in all the beautiful stone bridges, or at least the originals of the bridges that we now see across Camp Creek. Blair Athol, which is now the Flying W Ranch, was named after John Blair. Picnicking was a very important event for late Victorian people of substance, and General Palmer and his family specialized in picnics. They were elaborate affairs, almost rituals, and many picnics took place in North Glen Eyrie, where the castle concrete area is now, and beyond it in Blair Athol. The Glen has always presented several problems as regards the planting of flowers and trees. The first problem is flash floods. The second is the arid conditions. The third, the barrenness of the soil. And as if those three were not enough, the fourth, of course, is the deer. They eat everything. And for Palmer, the fifth was his dogs. We have no dogs here. The flash floods. Flooding has been occasional but very severe. In 1921, there was the so-called Pueblo flood. 18 inches of gravel was deposited down at the gatehouse where you came in. and all the two of the bridges were taken out, and the canyon pond, which is in the car park, where the car park is now, was destroyed. In 1935, the Memorial Day flood. This was the worst disaster in the history of Colorado Springs. 250 people were killed in the Memorial Day flood. 510 homes were destroyed. And the original canyon trail that Palmer had built all the way up the canyon towards Eagle Lake was totally removed. The latest bad flood was in 1947. In a way, we're due for another one. In 1947, on the 10th of May, I'd like to read an eyewitness account. Around 7 p.m., without any warning, a flood of water came roaring down Queens Canyon. There was a cloudburst up in the mountains. There was the complete destruction of all the footbridges across the creek, the washing away of several acres of beautiful lawns, trees, fences, reflecting pools were destroyed. Most of the gravel roads were completely washed away. Thousands of tons of boulder and gravel had to be removed. The value of Glen Eyrie as an estate was reduced from $485,000 to a salvage value of $100,000 only. This was in 1947, and parenthetically, this is one of the reasons why George Strait was so eager to sell to anybody, even the navigators, because he didn't want that to happen again. The second problem has been the arid conditions, at least arid conditions when we're not in flood. To provide the irrigation that General Palmer needed, he hired a man by the name of Herbert Reed to completely overhaul the water system from 1898 onwards. And for those of you who are interested, that map over there under the screen shows the water system developed in 1898. It's Reed's principal diagram describing what he intended to do. Eventually, he built 18 reservoirs, all of them fed off Camp Creek. Isn't that surprising? Because the creek was empty when you saw it today. But 90% of the water that runs down through Glen Eyrie is underground, subterranean. So in his day, in Palmer's day, 40 acres of the glen were irrigated. We only irrigate 14 now. And there were also extensive orchards and alfalfa fields down in the lower valley. Engineer Reed was an innovator. In the late 1890s, he tapped into these subterranean flows, and he built what is called a phreatic ditch. It wasn't a ditch, really. It was an underground porous pipe, but it collected all the water that ran underground, or most of it, and fed it into reservoirs further down the valley. So he was able to do a lot of irrigation and therefore a lot of horticulture. He updated the system, which was put in by the original plumber who worked for General Palmer, who rejoices under the name of Mr. Drinkwater. Nice name for a plumber, isn't it? In 1879, Mr. Drinkwater had put in several fountains throughout the grounds, and his work was declared to be as complete a system of waterworks as had ever been installed in the West. So Engineer Reed improved on that. And meanwhile, John Blair was building in the 1870s and 80s his beautiful rustic stone bridges. As we seek to imagine, to look back and think what the grounds must have looked like in Palmer's day, we should bear in mind that Kemp Creek nourished quite a few ponds, ornamental ponds, fish ponds. There was a willow pond where the castle car park is, where you parked. That wasn't there, of course. It was just a pond. No cars then. There was a bridged pond between here and the little schoolhouse down in the valley. There was a duck pond south of the carriage house. There was a lake where the sports green is in the middle there of the valley. There was the lily pond near what we call Bighorn. And there were two fish ponds near the gate. And there were also six reservoirs and a large swimming pool, all within the glen itself. Not talking about the other property that Palmer owned. So much for water. What about the barren soil? The soil is generally coarse and shallow and is usually sandy, other than along the banks of the stream. And each year, Palmer's gardeners used to spend a lot of effort hauling manure from Manitou. We have the records, for example, from 1883, where the gardeners made several trips to and from Manitou, hauling manure for more than 2 weeks in the spring. Cultivation was intense in the 1880s and the 1890s. In 1883, for example, The crops that were grown here within the actual area of Glen Eyrie included peas, beans, onions, parsnips, raspberries, asparagus, gooseberries, alfalfa, currants, vines, mushrooms, celery, apricots, peaches, nectarines, roses, clematis, gladioli, lily of the valley, rhododendrons, hyacinths, honeysuckle, carnations, and azaleas, and another dozen that I haven't taken time to mention. And all of this is documented. Palmer even brought in Kentucky bluegrass, and because he was a perfectionist, he brought Kentucky soil to put his Kentucky bluegrass on. There were two greenhouses down by the gatehouse where you came in. Later, when they found that they weren't getting enough sunlight because they were a bit sheltered, they built two very grand greenhouses in 1906, built by Lord and Burnham of New York, and they are, or they were until the 1960s, attached to the side of the gardener's house and were used by the navigators for several years after we arrived. There was also a grapery, and there was also a conservatory, which featured a fountain with goldfish. Now, the general was especially fascinated with trees, and I want to give two evidences of this. The first evidence, I could take you down to the patio of the castle, just down near the main door, and if you went down onto the grass and you looked under the patio, you would see something that looks like a stone kiln. It's circular, it's about so wide, and it looks very strong and very heavy. When this castle was being built, there was a beautiful tree growing there, and General Palmer sent word from Europe that on no account was that tree to be damaged or touched by the building. And so his builders built this protection for the tree, which used to come up through the stone of the patio for many years until it died. More significantly, General Palmer served for several years until his death as the president of the International Society of Arboriculture, of tree culture. The society reports that his liberality and counsel enabled them to distribute several tons of forest tree seeds and several million saplings throughout all portions of the world. We, of course, know that he gave most of our park system to the city. He also gave an experimental forestry area to Colorado College. And the society, in mourning his loss, said this, quote, "He was a lover of trees and flowers. He was thoroughly versed in the character, the habits, and the origin of all trees and plants." Unquote. A slight overstatement, but you could feel that they missed him. A couple more details concerning the conduct of the horticulture at that time. There were mushrooms grown here. As some of you may not know, mushrooms are often grown in a mushroom mine. We have a mushroom mine on Glen Eyrie, built into the side of the hill near what we now call Aspen Manor. Mushrooms have to be grown in the dampness and the dark. And there was large crops of mushrooms for many years. Most of the early trees on the glen, to my surprise, were deciduous. Very, very few fir trees. If you look at these photographs that are on the speaker there, you'll find some color photographs of the vegetation in the first and second decades of this century. And you'll see how different Glen Eyrie looks. Surprising. The Rose Arbor was constructed in 1906 across the valley from here. We still have the detailed designs. They're out in the corridor. And the society are going to reconstitute that arbor to make it like it was in its days of beauty. In those days, there were a lot of boxwoods in the Rose Arbor. And because boxwoods are not a natural plant in this part of the world, the gardeners had to remove them each fall, put them in cold frames for the winter, and bring them back and replant them in the spring. Money was no object for General Palmer. Everything had to be just right. Let me give you an idea of the scale of operations in the last decade of his life. Let me take the order that he placed and had delivered here in May of 1906. He just ordered, in a single order, 146 trees, 446 shrubs, and more than 2,000 perennials. That would do for 1906, he felt. And he kept doing this for several years. And in this order, among the 146 trees, he ordered 75 cottonwoods, 30 blue spruce, 30 elm, 25 ash, 15 sycamore, 8 willow trees, and so on and so on. Beautiful it must have been. In fact, we have a very detailed set of planting proposals by a James Dawson, which was submitted to the general around 1907, and which describes in intimate detail how the place looked. There were many tourists that were allowed into the glen, surprisingly, in those years. There was even a place along the other side of the valley here, where our road still runs, called the Tourist Drive. City people were allowed in. They came up on the Tourist Drive. They were not allowed near the castle. That's where the family were. And they were allowed to look over something that was called the Tourist Wall. And then they were allowed to stand by the fountain and have their photograph taken and so on. The fountain is down in the middle of the valley there, or was. So there was quite a lot of interest in the gardens. By the time that Palmer died in 1909, there were more than 100 miles of horseback trails constructed throughout the property. Many of them have still stones along the edges of them. And the reason for that is that he had them put there. He had these stones painted white so that he and his guests could ride at night and see. He wanted phosphorescent stones, but they wouldn't stay phosphorescent because of the weather, so he just painted them white. The gates on the estate were all battery-operated. Over there, there's an 1896 Columbia dry cell battery, which is taken from one of the electric gates that were on every horse trail. And what you do is very modern. You'd ride up, you put a little special key in. It was this high, you didn't get off your horse. The gate swung open and closed after you. We thought we were modern in putting in electric gates 3 years ago. Palmer put the electric gates in 1906, and we are just recovering some of the sophistication. A prospectus written in 1915, it's over on the table there, says, quote, "At nights the grounds are lighted with a rustic lighting system, all the wires are in conduits, and the wonderful rock formations are floodlit with large searchlights. The effect is quite awe-inspiring," unquote. And we have a charming set on the speaker here of color postcards of the grounds done in 1917 under the title Glen Eyrie, Land of Enchantment. Lilac is much in evidence in those cards. Now let me mention the Burkhard family. A generation earlier, as I told you, John Blair had come from Scotland through Canada to be the architect of the grounds. Now in 1906, on the very same day as the German bell from Krupp was put in the tower of the castle, Eugene, or Billy Burkhard, arrived from Germany with his three sons. He also had come through Canada. Two of these three sons, George and Otto, were invited to be here today, but they're very frail, and they send their warm greetings. The Burkhard family lived in the gardener's cottage, a frame house against the rock face below the eagle's nest. At least they lived there till 1918, when a massive boulder fell 10 yards from their home. So they moved to another building on the glen. But what you need to know about the Burkhards is that Billy Burkhard, the father, with his three sons, was responsible for the output of the Glen Eyrie greenhouses. And from 1922 to 1936, on the back of the handout that I have there, you'll see a list of all the rosettes and ribbons and cups and trophies that were won by the greenhouses of Glen Eyrie. Billy Burkhard was known in the West as the Chrysanthemum King. And these cups, this is one of them. This is one by the Glen Eyrie greenhouses for chrysanthemums. There are more here. There are more outside and around. And do look at them. They are a fascinating part of our history, and they were graciously donated to us 2 years ago by Otto Burkhard. We're very, very grateful for that. Billy also introduced a novelty to the West called broccoli. It was not known beforehand, and he was a champion winemaker. He founded Burkhard's Floral on North Wasatch in 1922. Let's go back to General Palmer's death in 1909. He left an estate which was then 3,000 acres, valued at just over $3 million. That would be about $51 million in today's money. But it decayed very quickly. He had three daughters. Two of them had recently married within the last 2 years of his life. And the estate was to be divided equally between the three of them. Therefore, it had to be sold. General Palmer's construction manager, a man by the name of Edmund Van Diest, who in fact built this castle for the general while the general traveled in Europe buying furniture and relaxing and traveling. Edmund Van Diest says in A Year After the General's Death, quote, "At Glenarry, everything looks deserted. The spirit pervading the place has gone, the family are scattered, and only the very simplest form of maintenance survives," unquote. Well, the place was purchased in 1916 by a group called the Oklahoma Syndicate. They started by charging admission. Now, you can tell how popular the gardens were by this fact. In two seasons, 1916 and 1917, they earned $45,000 in entrance fees for people who wanted to come and look at the gardens. It must have been magnificent. Strolling in the glen and seeing the gardens was a popular summer pastime for people of Colorado Springs. This Oklahoma syndicate was set to do a great deal of damage to this property. The details are over there in their prospectus. They intended to build 150 villa sites. They platted the whole of the glen here. This would be their main dining hall, but there were going to be 150 buildings. They were going to drive a tunnel through Echo Rock. They were going to build a bridge across Queens Canyon. They opened a Black Horse Tavern down in the carriage house. They opened a tea room. And in general, they just came close, very close, to destroying the place. Mercifully, they ran out of money. It was World War I, and the place was purchased by Alexander Cochrane, a rug manufacturer from Yonkers. And he rapidly extended the property. He doubled the size. He purchased another 3,000 acres and did a lot of cultivation and farming. He married a temperamental Polish opera singer called Ganna Wolska. They married secretly in Paris in 1922. Within 18 months, their marriage was collapsing. She had six marriages. She died recently, aged 100, in Montecito. She moved from him to Mr. McCormick, the head of the McCormick Reaper, and she went along collecting money through these six marriages, and it's true. And she spent her money in the development of something called Lotus Land in Santa Barbara. Have any of you seen Lotus Land? Magnificent gardens. Think what Ganna Wolska would have done if she could have managed to stay married to Mr. Cochrane. She would have restored Glenarry and more than restored it. Okay. During the 1930s, as it says on the handout, the place was held by an absentee landlord, the Hillbright Corporation, and then a man by the name of George Strake from Houston moved in. We acquired the Glen in 1953. Our first maintenance supervisor, a man by the name of John Crawford, did quite a few things that encourage us looking back on it. He put in two fine new duck ponds further down the valley there. We need to fill them again and sort of resuscitate them, but he did. And he made aesthetic improvements to the glen. He planted more than 300 trees in the 1950s. But to be fair, in view of the poor condition of the buildings, vegetation was not our first priority. This castle, for example, had been totally locked up from 1927, when the furniture was sold, until 1953, when we arrived. It was a morgue. I shouldn't say totally locked up. It was opened once a year on Halloween for the local children. And you can imagine there was no electricity system in the castle here. What fun it must have been to rush around these 60 rooms at night on Halloween as kids, just chasing one another and screaming and screeching. So that was the only time it was used, as far as we know. I have the notes of an early navigator meeting here at Glenarry, a very important meeting in many ways, and then there's this curious little footnote, rather plaintive footnote. The supervisor of our grounds says this. He wants to warn us. This is December 1957. Quote, "The evergreens have been thinned out considerably. We'll have nothing left in 10 years if we continue to remove 30 or 40 trees every Christmas." So I have this vision of early navigators just sawing down trees and taking them home at Christmas and decorating them. That's not very environmental, is it? That's why John Crawford planted 300 new ones, I think. But in 1984, seriously, we did commission a master plan because we take this environment very seriously. We want not only to preserve it, but we want to develop it and cultivate it. And somewhere here, there on the easel here, this is a summary of the master plan developed by Carl Johnson and his associates that we are trying to follow in developing the aesthetic quality of the experience of being at Glenarry. We do take that very seriously. 1992, we developed or renamed 11 of the walking trails that General Palmer had used, and we continue to work through Jeff Bullock at a tree planting program. And you'll see outside in the hallway as you leave brochures concerning the birds of Glen Eyrie and the animals of Glen Eyrie and the vegetation of Glen Eyrie. And I feel that these are symbolic of our real commitment to the maintenance of a good environment here. We want to sustain the beauty. We want to sustain the naturalness of this estate that God has lent to us. It's His. It's here for His glory. And we wanted to speak always of the beauty of His creation. Thank you very much.